Islamic State extremist known as Jihadi John has been killed. A series of airstrikes targeted the militant, whose real name is Mohammed Mwazi, in Syria. Colonel Steve Warren says it was carried out successfully.
We know for a fact that the weapon system hit its intended target and that the personnel were on the receiving end of that weapon system were in fact killed. We still have to finalize the verification that those personnel were specifically who we thought they were.
Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond's just given this update.
I can't tell you for sure that the strike was successful because we don't have that information yet. We're obviously pursuing all avenues to confirm, although we believe the strike was successful.
David Cameron says the attack was the right thing to do. The Labour leader says it would have been better if he had been brought to court. In other news, a judge has had to stop and compose himself as he sentenced the killers of schoolgirl Becky Watts in Bristol. Her stepbrother, Nathan Matthews, has been jailed for a minimum of 33 years for murder. His girlfriend's been given a 17-year term for manslaughter. Becky's grandfather, John Goldsworthy, says it's been a long and painful journey.
Time can never heal, but it will allow us to come to terms with our loss and live the lives with this experience now part of us and the lessons learned from it.
A man's been charged with attempting to murder a police officer by pushing him off a bridge in Newcastle. The incident happened above a busy dual carriageway as the officer responded to reports of an assault. The former Top Gear producer who was punched by Jeremy Clarkson is suing him. Oisin Timmin claims he was racially discriminated against. And India's Prime Minister is preparing to make a speech to thousands of people at Wembley Stadium as part of his UK visit. Earlier, Narendra Modi met the Queen at Buckingham Palace. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
Yeah, man. Yeah. A great movie. Met by the young generation of Malcolm X Community Center. Premier screening at the Africa Eye Film Festival. Down by the watershed. That's over there. 14th of November, 12:30. Don't be late.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Bristol's Green Party mayor candidate Tony Dyer. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, annual commemoration day at Colston Girls' School and charter day for the Merchant Venturers. Hundreds of school children bust into Bristol Cathedral to listen to Bishop Mike's secret sermon while the parents are locked outside waiting in the cold. Some call it enervating for the soul, others indoctrination. And on Tuesday this week, the Merchant Venturers did it all again. The annual Charter Day service closed to all but the Bristol school children from the schools the Merchant Venturers control. And the installing of a new master. This year's master is Tim Ross, a company lawyer from the City of London. So, who's he? And 20 years after the extraordinary panorama interview with Princess Diana today, what do the spooks think about her death? Fanatical loyalty, control freakery, vast wealth going back centuries, while the peasants begin to starve outside the castle walls. Is the British royal family a cult? That's what dying Australian Diana assassination author John Morgan believes, and he should know. He escaped from one. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 degrees Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs around 14 Celsius. Heavier showers on Saturday, mainly cloudy on Sunday. Generally windy through the weekend, though. Next week, highs of 14 Celsius. Plenty of wet and windy weather this week. Some sunny spells. And next weekend, the 21st and 22nd of November, highs down to 10. Much colder. Sunny, feeling much colder and a bit windy, too. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the Weather Outlook. bristolgreen.com. So helping us review the news this week is Bristol's Green Party's mayor candidate, Tony Dyer. Hi, Tony. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
Tell us a bit about yourself, Tony. How long have you been in Bristol and why the Green Party?
I was born and bred in Bristol. I was brought up on the Arcliffe Estate in the south of the city. Lived here for most of my life, or through, like many South Bristolians, I left the city to pursue my career elsewhere because of a lack of opportunity. So I moved out of the city for a while, worked in London and a few other places, and then felt the real need to come back to this city and to get more closely involved.
What about your career? What were you doing?
I started off working, well, when I first left school, I went into the construction industry. I was a builder, which was the family thing at the time. I was a third generation builder. But after a while, I retrained and moved into the IT training industry. I was involved in vocational training and helping new businesses get started, teaching computer skills to various people. I then moved on to... I was actually headhunted by a major computer company, I won't name them, and then worked with a couple of other major computer companies, and then eventually ended up doing some work in the City of London.
Now, can't I persuade you to name them? Well, I mean, surely you're open about who you've worked for, haven't you?
I worked originally for the company that first recruited me was Digital Equipment Company, which at that time was the second largest computer company in the world.
So why did they, do you think, what was the particular skills that you had that they wanted?
I think what I'd demonstrated, or what somebody had persuaded them of, was very good at doing was communicating between different types of skill sets. So, for instance, I was able to explain financial information to technical people and technical information to marketing people and marketing information to financial people. So I was kind of a translator of the different acronyms and so on that people tended to use.
The jargon, yeah, we get quite a lot of that on here. Martin Summers, you know, this is something in economics and in the city, it's almost a completely different language, isn't it?
Well, I mean, inevitably in any kind of specialised area, you've got specialised language used. But of course, in economics, there's also a deliberate attempt to mislead and confuse.
Tony, you're at work in the City of London, because I know you did a bit of work there too. Was it doing computer training?
At that time, I basically moved up the ladder a little bit, and I was more involved in helping organisations with their business strategies and implementing different systems. So, for instance, one of the things I was involved with was something called Quants, which is basically high-speed, very fast computerised trading.
Okay, so that sounds to me a bit dangerous, because if things start to slide, that is to say share prices start to dip, isn't it quite feasible that computers will detect that, and in microseconds they could create the biggest crash the planet Earth has ever seen?
There are supposed to be safeguards put in place to stop it happening, but there are situations where what we're talking about is decisions being made in nanoseconds and massive trades being done at a very short period of time. And what they can sometimes do is trigger human actions afterwards. So the computer basically reacts to a set figure without knowing the background behind it, and then that triggers human interaction behind.
Well, that sounds really dangerous. Martin, can you just give us an idea of who are the big players around the world in being quicker, a nanosecond quicker, to sell their stocks and shares during a crash, for example?
Well, I imagine Tony knows more about this than I do, but I'm aware that Goldman Sachs at one stage had a computer that knew that was plugged into the main exchange on the Wall Street, but it got a nanosecond before everybody else, it got the info that everybody else got, and of course that nanosecond was enough for them to actually make only a tiny amount of money on each trade. But when you're doing millions of trades, you can get, and it's basically money for old rope. It's just like milking a cow. Every day the computer plugged in, which has got that nanosecond on everybody else, is in position to basically milk the market.
Yeah, and can I just add to that as well, what some of the biggest and most torturous discussions that happen in some of the trading floors is how close you are to the computer, and even through it maybe just be a couple of feet, this difference in how close you are to the main computer,
physical
difference,
yeah.
there was a lot of fighting over who gets that place closest, and it does tend to be some of the bigger organisations.
Well, it's like, so it's like the animal kingdom, you know, somebody's got to be the biggest beast, haven't they?
Yeah.
So what do you learn from that actually started your track to the Green Party? I mean, why the Green Party particularly, Tony?
Well, the Green Party in particular, because I think the Green Party is willing to look at the system and not just simply assume that we have to carry on as we've done so before. One of the things I learnt from working in the financial sector was, one, how little knowledge there was of the real world within the financial sector. As I said, there were decisions being made basically just on a computer algorithm rather than any background behind what might be causing a particular fluctuation in a company's performance. And I think the other thing was looking at it was how much of the trading being done in places like the City of London bear no reality whatsoever to the resources actually in play. So, for example, you have a situation where for every wheelbarrow of oil that's traded, there's about 17 virtual barrow of oil based on derivatives, which often ends up with the virtual barrow of oil driving the price rather than the real cost of oil.
Well, this is another one of those lovely city terms that no one is really supposed to understand, isn't it? A derivative. What is a derivative?
A derivative, I'm trying to think of a way of phrasing that. Essentially, it's a trade which is not necessarily based on the real resource, but on what might happen to that resource at some point in the future. Or sometimes it may be on almost like it's essentially like having a bet on potential outcomes rather than the actual value of the item that's being sold at the time.
Well, the argument for that, of course, is well, this helps companies hedge, doesn't it? It says, well, if the price falls, we need to know a little bit more. You know, the idea is that the market can be can cause companies not to invest because of the uncertainty, and this. Doesn't it? I may be wrong here, but isn't the idea to sort of make it more certain what the price is going to be if they're betting ahead?
The kind of
insurance, really, in a way.
Yeah, there is insurance and reinsurance, and a lot of the hedge funds basically work. Their whole idea is provide a level of reinsurance to hedge your bets effectively. But what you also have situations is where the derivatives are being designed on the basis that they're going to fail in order to provide the option to build another derivative from that. And that isn't really of use to the economy at large. It's basically self-fulfilling.
Well, I think you probably got more knowledge of this than I have, but I mean, my understanding of it is that derivatives, to my mind, are insurance on the cheap. Yeah, I mean, insurance companies like Lloyd's have all sorts of regulations around them, and you can only insure if you've got an insurable interest. But as a derivative trader, you can make a bet on anything, the 330 at Newmarket, whatever it may be. And, of course, it's a bit of a delusion, because when in the 2008 the market crashed, the counterparties that are supposed to turn up and pay for your bet then disappear because they've basically gone bankrupt. And Lloyd's, of course, is supposed to be sufficiently capitalised by the names and all the rest of it that they can cover when the insurance requires to be covered. And it's a delusion. So instead of buying proper insurance, which is expensive, you can buy a derivative to cover yourself against fluctuations in the price of what you're selling. And then it leads people to think, oh, we're covered on that one. But in actual fact, you're not, because when a crash happens, the people you've done the deal with just disappear in a puff of smoke, and there isn't actually any money there anyway. And that's the real danger with it. And Brooksley Bourne, who was the head of the Social Securities and Exchange Commission in the US when derivatives were first being produced, said, well, they shouldn't allow these because this is insurance, but it's not insurance. And of course she was shuffled aside, and they said no, you don't understand it, but basically, to my mind, the derivatives should exist for certain things to cover things that are going to fluctuate in price, there should be a minor product just for very specialised markets, but they've become dominant. I mean, the derivatives market now is massively bigger than the whole world economy on electronic paper. That can't be right, and it's an incredibly dangerous house of cards.
Can I just add a couple of two quick points to that as well? Is where the insurance idea starts to fall down a little bit is that usually when you get insurance, it's because you're insuring against something that you own and something.
Yeah. You've got an insurable interest.
And with derivatives, you don't even have to own the product that's
being
insured.
Well, can't you see, people see what's wrong with that? Well, I can take a bet that your factory is going to burn down. Not my factory, your factory. Can't people see what's wrong with that? Why that was illegal in the past?
And then also the other side of that, and you might say connected to that, is the fact there are wars and regulations that, or through, you know, increasingly limited regulation, that control the normal stock market and so on, but with derivatives, they're largely no controls, no regulations whatsoever.
Well, look, what you're doing is you're standing for mayor for the Green Party in Bristol next year, Tony. Give us an idea of your vision for the city. What do you think you're going to bring that George Ferguson hasn't?
I think my approach is going to be very much coloured by my background. My background is one, I grew up in a relatively poor family in a relatively deprived part of the city. But I've also gone away from that and also have experience of working in quite a well-paid job as well and seen the other side of it. And I think what I want to bring to the city and what I want to bring to the campaign is looking at how we can use and make the best use of what's in this city. This is potentially a fantastic city. It's a good city, but it has the potential to be so much better. But to be able to make it better, we need to be able to invest in those things that can improve
the city. Hang on, surely the job of mayor is about making it worse, because all you're doing really is cuts, and it's deciding where the next cuts are going to be.
There is, unfortunately, at the moment as it stands, there is an element of that, whoever, if the envelope that we have to operate within remains the same, then there are going to be cuts. And what we have to look at is what can we do to, one, to make sure those cuts, wherever possible, are steered away from the most vulnerable of people, the people you do not have any other alternatives. But what we also have to do is tackle the government and say, look, there are some things in this city that we can do. Allow us, you'll talk about devolution, give us real devolution, allow us to invest in the things that we know can generate jobs, can generate decent housing, and that's we would give you a return in that investment.
Okay, so let's look in the crystal ball. You win. What's your first day as mayor going to be? What are you actually going to do?
Well, my first day as mayor will be to review the programmes that are currently in place and look at which ones are actually working for the best effect for the city at large, and that may be looking at changing and moving some money away from some projects into other projects.
Well, come on, get a bit specific. What are the sorts of things do you think are maybe we're wasting our council tax money on at the moment?
I think the Metro bus scheme needs to be looked at very carefully. I think the amount of money that's been thrown at that, it seems to be forever going up and up, and I'm not convinced that we are going to get the return from that we have been promised. There's one of the things that was required for Metro bus to work is somebody to actually come forward to agree to run the buses down the Metro bus network. As far as I know, I've had no commitment from any potential bus supplier to say they're even going to put their buses down the guided busways. I think we need to get that clarified. Is there a bus company willing to do that?
Oh, that sounds a bit crazy, doesn't it, Martin? No bus operator has actually agreed to run these buses. I mean, they're guided buses, aren't they? It's kind of guided rail, a halfway house between a tram and a bus.
Well, I mean, I must say, I'm not running for mayor, so I haven't got the grasp of detail that Tony's obviously going to need if he's going to do that. What I think about running for mayor of Bristol is the reality is that decisions are not made at this level. But Bristol is a major city in Britain, and if we got a radical mayor of any stripe, that's a message to the people at the other end of the M4 that we're coming for them, and that's the way it's got to work. You mean, if that's where the power is, that's where we're going to go. And the Bristol changed hands twice during the Civil War because it was a key part of winning national power in Britain, and I think that's we still potentially could fulfil that role, you know, like if you like the way that Ken Livingstone led London in the 80s, and I could see a good progressive mayor in Bristol, whoever it may be, championing not just Bristol, but questioning the whole austerity policy, the whole direction of national policy, and I would like to see any mayor elected standing up to national government. Not in a destructive way, like Liverpool City Council refusing to set a rate. But on the other hand, it should be clear that, you know, we're not just locally focused. I mean, that's, I think, where George Ferguson's gone wrong. He sees it all as a problem of, you know, management within Bristol.
Well, that's
national policy, which destroys the possibility of doing anything constructive.
It's certainly true. I mean, we've had George on here a couple of times recently, sort of pressing him on whether he would criticise and question the Westminster agenda, particularly to do with austerity, and he really just avoids the question. He isn't really standing up to whether austerity is a wise thing to do or not, Tony.
No, austerity is terrible economics. It's poor, bad, ideologically driven economics.
Well, why is that? Because, I mean, surely you've got to save money somehow.
You save money. You don't save money by basically failing to invest and then creating further problems.
Well, you've got to deal with here. I mean, we're talking about the national picture here. Is you've got particularly a welfare budget which is going up all the time, where even people who are mid to low range paid need to be claiming benefits. So you've got to do something about that. You can't allow it to balloon up out of all proportion.
But what's happened since this government has started to implement an austerity budget is that that's exactly what has happened. Is that the welfare size has gone up simply because they haven't actually done anything to prevent it increasing. They've taken money out of the economy.
But what about, say, the bedroom tax, for example? That's a really good example, isn't it?
Yeah, the bedroom tax was implemented. I think even the Lib Dems are now admitted that they were wanting to support the bedroom tax. The bedroom tax basically said, well, we're going to charge you extra for a room, but we're not going to supply you with any alternative way of avoiding having to pay the bedroom tax. We have to... Can I give you a couple of quick examples? If you look at Bristol, for instance, Bristol is one of the wealthiest cities in this country. So it generates considerable number of business rates. And of those business rates, we send half of those business rates up to London, and then we get some money back in return, and the gap is about 50 million a year. Now, if we were allowed to keep those business rates here in Bristol, we can invest that into infrastructure projects that address the problems that create the need for benefits, such as creating decent paid jobs, such as creating a housing that people can afford to live in without having to claim so much housing benefit. And we can reduce the benefit bill that way, in a positive way, by creating jobs, creating housing, reducing the transport problems, and also, probably most important of all, is actually giving people the skills and education they need to be able to do the jobs that we need to create to make this city able to cope with the future that's coming.
Now, one of the biggest plans for investment at the moment is the arena. What are your thoughts about that? You can already see work starting down by Temple Meads.
Well, it looks like the arena is going to go ahead. How much impact will have economically? It will create some jobs in construction. And there will obviously be some jobs created once it's open.
Well, it's going to create hundreds, possibly thousands of jobs, surely,
building it. Some of those jobs will be temporary, because once the construction is over. But I don't think the arena, a lot of people in Bristol have been fighting for an arena for quite a long time. It's been promised for so long. But we have to make sure that, you know, if you're building an arena next to a train station, then we try to encourage public transport as much as possible. And what we also have to do is, if you're going to encourage people to use public transport, then you also need to find a way to ensure that people do use that public transport and not park in the streets of nearby places like Windmill Hill, for instance.
Now, let's have a look at some of the stories this week. Actually, it's really just the end of last week, but we didn't really cover it properly last week, so we really must, because this is the St Paul's African Caribbean Carnival. The trustees of the St Paul's African Caribbean Carnival committee put up a blog post at the end of last week saying they're very disappointed that key funders Bristol City Council and Arts Council England have chosen not to continue their support for St Paul's Carnival, despite their tireless efforts to meet funding conditions against a backdrop of barriers and hurdles. We believe it's the wrong decision. Attended a meeting at 11 a.m. on the 3rd of November and was shocked that an official press release was prepared and out by the time we returned to the Carnival office less than 30 minutes months later, despite the powers that be not allowing us to hold the main carnival event this year. Through sheer determination, we delivered a grassroots showcase event, which was a success in terms of putting the community, artists and culture at the heart of it. Was well supported. It was not good enough for the funders. Now, it seems that the funding is being pulled from effectively what is a community organised St Paul's Carnival, Tony, and that George Ferguson and the City Council, Chief of Executive, etc., want to manage this directly from City Hall.
Well, we used to have that something similar to that situation before, back in 2010-2011. There was, I think it was called the Arts Carnival and Festivals team within Bristol City Council who used to do that. And I think nearly that was shut down, and nearly all the people involved in that were made redundant back in 2011. But I think there's clearly been a real breakdown in both communication and trust here. There's obviously, for whatever reason, Bristol City Council have clearly decided that they no longer have trust in the current organisers to go ahead with it. And it's clear from what you've just said that the current organisers are very disappointed and very upset about how that's come about. But it does seem to me that, you know, at some point you would expect there would have been conversations going on, and for them to be so surprised at this turn of event seems to imply that, you know, they weren't kept informed as much as they wanted to be.
But it's something, this sort of rankles a little bit about this with me, Martin. I don't know what you think. You've got an ex-merchant venturer mayor telling the Afro-Caribbean population that they can't manage their own carnival. Well, we're going to have to do it for you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about the politics of the carnival organisers. I mean, obviously, that sometimes people may say, well, they can't manage it, they're not capable or whatever. But I must say, I love the carnival. I've always loved it. It's a massively popular event, and you get a much bigger cross-section of the community there than you get at things like the Harbour Festival, for example. So, you know, it's not surprising that people in St Paul's see this as a snub, because it is a snub, isn't it? Let's face it.
Also, shake up for Bristol's wards. This is in the Bristol Post this week. We will still have a total of 70 councillors. Bristol's wards are being, that is our sort of constituencies, isn't it, to elect councillors, are being reshuffled, so the number of voters in each one are about the same. It will mean some wards will have three councillors, while others will have only one. Most of them will still have two councillors, and there'll still be 70 councillors on the City Council as currently. The wards with three councillors, well, I better not go through them all. But anyway, Martin, I know you've got some thoughts about this, because the current electoral register isn't necessarily accurate, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, as somebody who does knock on doors, as Tony does, we are very aware in the inner city areas that there are large numbers of people, particularly in multiple occupancy houses. In the house I'm living in now, I'm the only person registered to vote in that house, as far as I can see, and I know there are at least five other people living there. And this is sinister enough. But because if the electoral registers are then used to redraw the boundaries, as the Tories are talking about
they're talking about doing it here in Bristol,
yes,
right
I know,
now.
I'm just widening the discussion to the way in which they're going to try and reform the electoral boundaries for the House of Commons. And also the way the individual registration instead of household registration has clearly led to a lower number of people being registered. We know in Bristol West, for example, that less people are registered to vote the last election than the previous election, even though we know that the population has increased. And of course the Tories are perfectly happy with this. This is US style politics, where the poor and the marginalised are basically not encouraged to participate. We don't want them, and we redraw the boundaries on the basis of householders who are already on the housing ladder or whatever. Those are the people we want to vote. We don't want all these poor people involved.
Yeah, it concerns me as well, and I think both the Green Party and the Labour Party we are concerned about the way this seems to be done as a solution to a problem that doesn't really exist. I mean, one of the reasons we were given was previously the way people was registered was open to fraud, but there hasn't been significant examples of that happening in Bristol, and there are worries that a lot of people are going to be even they're just assuming that they are on the register.
And well, I'll tell you what is open to fraud. That's the postal voting system, the whole entire system that's been around since the 1980s, 90s. That really is open to fraud. I mean, what we're talking about here, this kind of shocks me when I read this, and there's no mention of any of the horrific pitfalls of this in the Bristol Post article at all, is that what you're doing is you're redrawing these boundaries based on what is effectively a very incomplete register, where a lot of the poorest in society are simply not on that voting register.
Yeah, and I think that is worrying. One of the things that ourselves and a couple of the other parties were trying to get was that it was clear that in central Bristol, in the inner city in particular, we had wards that had a lot more people per councillor than some of the wards, particularly in Bristol North West, and we wanted to get a more even distribution. But that only works if you have an accurate idea of all the people that are not only already registered, but likely to be registered.
Yeah, but which we don't. Anyway, let's move on and have a listen now to an extract from the Today programme, because this is something I personally am really concerned about. It's the it's called Snooper's Charter. It's Theresa May has just introduced, and you, it would be very interesting to hear your comments, Tony Dyer. You're standing to be Bristol Mayor for the Green Party next May, to see what you make of what Theresa May has to say here. So let's have a listen to Today programme from, I'm not quite sure which day it was, but anyway, it was the day that Theresa May announced the new version of the Snooper's Charter.
I suspect that there are many people listening to this programme who feel that actually we haven't, as a society in the past, been positive enough about the values that unite us as a society.
What does that mean? Forgive me for using the phrase again, but that's a bit woolly, isn't it? Positive enough. I mean, I could run out into the street now, and you couldn't say, look, these are the values we all stand for. Wonderful, wonderful. Somebody else would come along and say, rubbish, I believe in something different. Now, at what point, what I'm really puzzled by is how you get to define the line. You draw the line at which you've crossed over that line, and it's unacceptable, legally unacceptable.
Well, that is, if I may, the one part of what we're doing is the legislation, which has the banning orders, the disruption orders, the ability to close premises. And that will have within it, will have definitions of extremism. We've set out a definition of extremism at the moment, but we'll very clearly set out in the legislation how those banning orders will operate.
So what is extremism? Because we have loads of laws that ban, for instance, hate speech, all sorts of laws. You obviously can't incite violence. That is a criminal offence. You go to jail for it. What is it that we are trying to ban?
Well, we are trying to deal with those situations, with those in our society who are actively operating or promoting an extremism which is undermining. I know you say that promoting our values is something that you say is woolly, but actually,
well,
what
it's valuable,
people are trying
of course,
to do,
but it's
it,
but it
well,
is
thank
woolly.
You. It is
clearly it's woolly it because is. It could mean anything, couldn't it? I mean, depending on who you are. If, for instance, you believe in gay marriage, fine, that is a value for you. If you don't believe in gay marriage, you're absolutely entitled not to believe in gay marriage, and presumably you would still be entitled to say, I don't believe in gay marriage.
Of course,
I think
you would be.
I think it damages society.
Yes, but not,
that, so that would offend your values.
But what we're talking about is the key values that underline our society and are being undermined by the extremists. Values like democracy, a belief in democracy, a belief in the rule of law, a belief in tolerance for other people, equality, an acceptance of other people's faiths and religions. We all have one of the great things about living in the United Kingdom is that we all have a right to live our lives as we choose to live our lives. But we also have a responsibility to respect other people's right to live their lives as they choose
but
to live.
And
what we are, sorry, John, because I think this is important. What we are seeing is people undermining what I would call those fundamental values of democracy and the rule of law and of tolerance of other people, and doing that in a way which can lead people down the route of radicalisation and then obviously can lead them
right
into violence and into taking action to try to undermine our society.
But it's entirely possible, isn't it, that if you don't ban those people but instead, as it were, allow them to hide in plain sight of everybody, it will lead you to those who actually do want to break the law, who do want to kill people in pursuit of their aims, and it might be counterproductive what you're trying to do.
No, I think what we're trying to do is will be part of a wider strategy, which is about ensuring that we can, on the one hand, introduce this legislation, which we're talking about today, with these banning orders in it, but also there are other parts to this strategy. There will be a programme to help isolated communities, a programme to actively promote our British values, looking at issues like entryism in bodies. I mean, I think many people were deeply concerned when they saw the issue that arose, that what was called the Trojan horse, in the schools in Birmingham, at the attempts to change young minds that was taking place as a result of that. People were concerned about that, and we need to ask the question about how that happened and what we can do in order to ensure that it doesn't happen again. This is about ensuring that we have and maintain what keeps us together and what makes this a great country to live in our pluralistic values.
There's Theresa May, the Home Secretary, talking about her new extremism orders, not the Snoopers Charter, as I was saying, but things like extremism disruption orders, Tony Dyer. What do you make of them? Because as John Humphreys was quite cleverly pointing out there, it is one person's extremist is someone else's friend.
Yeah, it's... You just listen to stuff like that, and it does make you wonder what type of country we're in danger of turning into, where it suddenly becomes, yeah, we're a tolerant society only as long as you agree with our particular view of that society. This does deeply worry me. I mean, there's always of cloaking it in terms of talking about, oh, it's about our security and so on, but it's a dangerous path to go down, and it... I would be very reluctant if I was elected as Mayor of Worcester to implement those sort of powers if they were handed down to...
I know we heard from, I think it was Steve Comer a few weeks ago, Martin, didn't we, that when the Prevent strategy came along, Bristol City councillors actually kicked it out. They said, this is not going to work, and they refused to implement it. And in fact, we've just heard today, haven't we, about the drone killing, at least apparent drone killing, of Mohammed Emwazi over in Syria or Iraq, I'm not quite sure where, but he was someone who went through the whole Prevent strategy, and MI5 have got to hold their hands up and say, well, actually what we did is we actually radicalised him and turned him into a maniacal terrorist.
A number of points I'd make here. First of all, as far as I'm concerned, our values are, as Voltaire said, I despise what you say, but I defend to the death your right to say it. And the attempts, for example, in the past to stop Sinn Féin appearing on BBC had no effect whatsoever on the people who supported Sinn Féin. In actual fact, it just reminded them every time they switched on the TV of how unfair the government was. Second point, I'm going to use my freedom of speech to point out a couple of things. The Trojan horse was all based upon a forged facts. We all agree that now. That's been established as a fact.
Now, maybe Theresa May doesn't know that.
No, and do you know what I suspect? I suspect that facts was... the forged facts which kicked the whole thing off may very well have been forged by our own security services. In other words, a deliberate attempt to smear the Muslim community. I'm using my freedom of speech to say that. I'll also point out that the British government and British armed forces and special forces have been training people to go into Syria and fight the legitimate government of Syria, which actually won the last election in the country, and those are exactly the same kind of people, like the jihadi John that's supposedly been attacked by the Americans. I don't believe a word they say, frankly, but we know for a fact that MIT in Turkey and the Mukhabarat in Saudi Arabia, all of whom are in cahoots with the CIA and MI6, have been arming and training jihadis from all over the Middle East and Britain and filtering them into Syria to fight the Syrian government. So I accuse the British government of being behind Islamist terrorism, and I'm sure that if we put the police in to look at this properly, maybe the police service of Northern Ireland, we'd find people like Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who was fingered by the British police as the major sponsor of terrorism in Northern Ireland, behind it all. I think the British government are actually behind a lot of Islamic terrorism, and the the former French foreign minister Roland Dumas went on French television 2 years ago and he said, before the Arab Spring, before the uprising in Syria, I was approached by British officials when I was a foreign minister, said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria, do you want to participate? So the finger of who runs Islamic terrorism terrorism, going back to the 1980s and Operation Cyclone, when the Americans and the British were taking jihadis from all over the world and filtering them into Afghanistan, is that they are the terrorists. And I use my freedom of speech to say that. And if you don't like it, perhaps you should try and close us down. But if you try and close us down, we will use our British values to punch you on the nose.
Martin, one of the things I've come across recently is this case, well, it's actually a couple of years ago, Mohammed Salim. He was walking home from a mosque one evening in Birmingham, and then he was murdered by a chap called Pavlo Lapshin. Now, Pavlo Lapshin was a Ukrainian neo-Nazi who had been brought into Britain by the Foreign Office on some special scheme, and he murdered this chap just 5 days later.
Yes, and of course there's also linkages between the neo-Nazis in the Ukraine and British and American special forces and intelligence services. They are also behind those extremists.
Well, they sound like extremists. If they're bringing in neo-Nazis, if they're bringing in neo-Nazis to kill Muslims.
MI6 works intimately with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, for example, which was the cutting edge of the people who overthrew Gaddafi, even though they are Al-Qaeda Libya, and they're very close to the Azov Battalion in the Ukraine, which is a neo-Nazi outfit. British Army is going to be training them. I accuse the Conservative government of being extremists, and no doubt many people in West Belfast would probably agree with me. But if we're really going to have a serious argument about this, let's have one.
Well, earlier this week I spoke to Maz Salim, who's the daughter of Mohammed Salim, who was murdered 2 years ago in Birmingham, and she explains that there were actually quite a lot of problems with the court case. Initially, the West Midlands police tried to blame her brother for the killing. They wouldn't admit that it was any kind of racial motivation, and they wouldn't call him a terrorist. So anyway, let's have a listen now to an extract from that interview with Maz Salim now.
Pavlo Lapshin arrived in the country within 5 days, murdered my father. He actually was living on the premises of Dalcam, which is a company down the road from us. And so Dad actually left the mosque about 10 past 10 p.m. and was walking home. And then what happened was there was more than one attacker, because we've seen the CCTV that the police dismissed all the evidence. So yeah, it was a blacked out SUV. One of the neighbours didn't notice this vehicle. So basically Dad was coming home from the mosque, and then he was stabbed 3 times from behind, back to front stab wounds. One of the stab wounds punctured Dad's lungs. But Dad turned around and went to give chase to the person, and that's when the other stab wound, we think, happened. The suspects ran down one of our local streets. I live, and obviously we asked to see the CCTV footage from those areas, because the police seemed to not be doing it themselves. So we did find the footage on one of the neighbours' camera of the suspect running down the street. The neighbours gave us all the CCTV in the area, so all the neighbours came to us, and then we actually told the police, like, look at this CCTV, because you could see more than one shadow around Dad's. And this was completely dismissed, and the police say, no, it's not that. And also the vehicle as well, which was really vital in the attack, the police dismissed and said, no, it was Villa fans looking for a pub. Bearing in mind, we live in a blues area, Birmingham City area, and why would Villa fans be in a blues area? And also we had a really difficult time with West Midlands police trying to convince them at the beginning that this was a racist attack. We actually told them, you know, this is what it is, and they were like, they more or less started investigating in the community instead of going to look further away where it could stem from.
So the police initially started investigating within the Asian community about who had killed her father, and they had to convince the police. In fact, they had to do the investigation for the police. This is a pretty horrific thing to happen to you if you've had your father killed, is that it's then your job to actually then go around and collect evidence. The police aren't going to pick up the CCTV images. The family themselves have to do that.
Well, that's because the police are working within a kind of mindset where they're not actually seeing what the real problems are. The far right in the Ukraine have intimate links with Western intelligence services. All the evidence that piles up now suggests that the sniper attacks in the Maidan Square at the beginning of the Kiev uprising were orchestrated by the new government. The new Kiev junta shot both police officers and police and protesters in order to kick off the coup. And that's actually a standard NATO operating
procedure. But sticking with Birmingham for a minute, in their situation, they made all sorts of complaints to the police, but then the police said that they would only release their father's body if they drop the complaints. I mean, this sort of thing, it does seem as if we've got, Tony, I mean, this is Birmingham, not Bristol, thank God, but institutionalised racism still going on in the police.
certainly sounds like it.
Doesn't it? I mean, it's deeply distressing if you listen to this, if you're that family. I mean, it's clear that they're not being treated and not being given the standard of service that we should expect from our police forces.
Yeah, and racism. I mean, for example, she's saying that the CCTV images showed more than one shadow over her father, that sort of thing. An SUV, blacked out windows,
in
driving
other words,
around.
This guy may not have acted alone.
No, exactly. So the thing is, the whole way that was painted was that this guy was just one lone nutter, and he wasn't. He clearly wasn't on the day, and also he was brought into Britain by the Foreign Office and by this computer company. It seems, even though another thing I found out about Lapshin was that he was a known bomber over in Ukraine, and he'd even blown up his mother's house with a bomb. Just the bigger picture, Martin. What's going on here with these extremism disruption orders?
Well, I think the extremism disruption orders is based on the idea that somehow it's the internet and people's opinions that are responsible for international terrorism. In actual fact, NATO's intelligence services, for example, MIT in Turkey, and their allies in Qatar and Saudi Arabia, working closely with the British SAS, etc., they are the terrorists. I put it absolutely clearly to people. That is what's going on. That's what the last 3 years in Syria should have made absolutely clear to anybody. And that's basically what the Russian general staff believe and what the Iranian general staff believe. Now, you don't hear that on Radio 4, do you? But that is what they believe. Now, whether it's true or not is something which I believe it is true, as it happens. And they've got the ways and means to find out. But the ordinary people in Britain need to understand that in the Middle East, we are, and in Syria, they did an opinion poll recently, I think it was done by YouGov or something like that. 80% of the people in Syria believe ISIS is a front for the CIA and MI6. 80%.
Well, I wonder how many people in Bristol do. Anyway, if you want to hear the whole interview with Maz Salim from Birmingham, you can hear that on our sister show Dialect, which is suspended at the moment from Bristol Community Radio. Not sure how long it's going to be until it's back on again. We're hoping very soon. But you can certainly listen to it online at Dialect Radio. That's one word, dialectradio.co.uk. Your final thoughts then, Tony Dyer? You're standing to be Mayor of Bristol for the Green Party about these extremism disruption orders.
Well, if we're trying to create a society that reflects the type of country we are, then it should be a country that appreciates that people are allowed to have different opinions, that people are allowed to express their views on the internet, and we also need to be certain that if a crime is committed, that it's investigated properly. That clearly doesn't appear to be the case in this Birmingham incident.
And also, I think there are plenty of laws, aren't there, actually, to stop people doing naughty things? Why do we need something called an extremism disruption order?
Exactly, as was pointed out by the BBC interviewer there. We've already got laws against hate speech and calling for violence. What more do we need?
Let's be blunt about this. This isn't really about what's needed to combat terrorism or extremism. It's about what sounds good on politics and what looks good on people's campaign leaflets.
Well, it's a demonisation of a whole community.
Yeah.
Care home sector in meltdown, with the UK's largest provider threatened by a US vulture fund. This is in The Independent last Friday. Missed it last Friday's show. Another one, I'm afraid. It's been a bit slack, I'm afraid. The UK's largest provider of care homes is preparing to sell scores of properties, slash its budgets by millions to fend off an attack from a US vulture fund, hoping to cash in on the UK elderly care crisis. Four Seasons Healthcare, which cares for thousands of residents, is facing a £500 million plus credit crunch after government's spending cuts and financial engineering by city investors left it struggling to pay lenders. The little-known H/2 Capital Partners has been buying up the group's debt in the hope that the current owners, Terra Firma, will cede control of the homes after finances were squeezed by local government funding cuts. Now, Tony, what do you make of this? Because this sounds a little bit to me like a bit like the Southern Cross scandal a couple of years ago, with a whole load of care homes just having to be sold off and closing.
Yeah, we have this problem of private profit being made in whatever way out of people's health and people's care situations. I mean, look, my view is that something like care homes should not be in the private sector. It should be something provided by the state.
Well, the argument is that actually they can do it cheaper than the government can.
Well, they probably can do it cheaper, but it's not a good quality of service. There's a massive proportion of very old people who have lost contact, or all their families are no longer in contact with them, you are essentially kept sedated for long periods of time, because that then means it's easier to look after them. They don't have to have so many staff on duty.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, you know, the public sector versus the private sector, because, of course, when home helps in Bristol City Council were privatised, or they put out that the existing structure was closed down, and the main effect of that was that the people who then took it over, the private sector providers, didn't pay the same kind of wages as the state paid. It's more expensive for the state to do it because they pay people a decent wage to do what was one of the most fundamentally important tasks in any society. It shouldn't be done by people on contract under for small amounts of money. Looking after elderly people should be a vocational job with a career structure and a decent wage at the end of the day for the people who do it, and that costs. And you know what? What's the alternative? There's no alternative. You either do it properly and pay the money. That's what a civilised society does. They don't bail out the banks. They don't bomb Syria. They look after their old folk.
Another story now. Inquiry to examine police spying on Labour MPs. And British authorities are mulling a thorough investigation into allegations that police spied on Labour lawmakers, including Jeremy Corbyn, back in the 1990s. Lord Justice Pitchford, senior judge leading the public inquiry into undercover policing, has ruled the probe should be focused on the allegations that police collected information about political activities of the politicians. Matters of importance to the inquiry are whether undercover police operations were directed at politicians, and if so, for what purpose, he said. Earlier in March this year, a former undercover officer revealed that police kept secret files on Labour politicians, including Jeremy Corbyn and Ken Livingstone, following the parliamentary elections. According to the whistleblower, a special branch of Metropolitan Police conducted spying operations on 10 Labour politicians, covertly monitoring them even after they'd been elected to the House of Commons. Tony, this is hasn't got a lot of coverage over here. I'm reading this off of the Iranian Press TV's English language site, but pretty shocking. A whistleblower saying that he was himself actually spying on elected politicians.
To be honest, it doesn't come as a surprise. One of our own elected politicians, Jenny Jones, was in the Green Party, was basically subject, and I believe was the subject of surveillance, and was also identified as being a domestic terrorist. And we are aware of situations where Green Party activities have been infiltrated, and people have passed themselves off as member of the Green
Just
Party.
Just give us an idea of something that's happened within the Green Party then, because this is a bit worrying. If they're going in there, police pretending to be members of the Green Party and actually maybe steering, or are they just actually just watching what's going on, or are they starting to get involved in steering discussions?
I think it's mainly, it's not just with the Green Party, but with the environmental movement at large. There's been instances of undercover police officers embedding themselves within groups.
Well, you can say the word embedding, but actually getting into bed literally with activists, Martin.
Yes, and actually giving them children, and then disappearing over the hill.
All at taxpayers' expense.
All at taxpayers' expense. I think that's pretty extreme, don't you? I think that's extremism.
Maybe.
And in actual fact, I would argue that that's illegal.
Maybe.
And that the police officers and intelligence officers who are involved in that should be identified and should be put in court, and they should be given exemplary sentences. Because their only defence would be that they had political clearance from people further up the line. Well, in that case, it's call those people and put them on trial.
Well,
if we're going to have a rule of law in this country, we are going to have a rule of law. We are going to get to the bottom of all of this kind of political policing and the so-called extremism, because a lot of this Islamist extremism, as I stressed earlier, has intimate links with our own intelligence.
One of the things
which they are criminals.
One of the things that's come up with the latest investigatory powers bill, a lot released last week, is that there is talk about judicial oversight of this. But both Conservative MP David Davis and Shami Chakrabarti from Liberty have pointed out that there isn't actually any real judicial oversight of these new surveillance powers at all, because all judges will have to do is to have a look to see if certain boxes have been ticked. They don't actually have an overall power to say no if they don't think that the person should be put under surveillance. So this is giving even more power security services.
And this is within a context where MI5 admitted the other week that they've bugged every telephone call in Britain for the last 10 years. And that other people, but certain elements of MI5 knew what was going on. Other people in MI5 didn't even know what was going on. That is completely illegal. Every single telephone call in Britain for the last 10 years has been bugged by the security services. The same security services I'm pointing the finger at as being behind Islamic extremism and supporting groups like the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group.
I mean, Tony, is there anything we can do about this? Because ultimately, you know, I don't know if my computer's been taken over. Say if something goes wrong on my computer, I've no idea whether that's because someone's hacked in. Maybe that's organised crime. Maybe it's a casual person. Maybe it's the security services, or maybe my computer just went wrong.
Yeah, what do we do about this? Because the way this country is going with laws like this, and no, if we looked at what we've discussed so far on this programme, it's whether it's the snooper's charter, the investigative powers, the extremism laws, there is a massive concern about how free is our society now. What are we able to do without us being listened to by people to whom we don't particularly want to be listened. We should have the freedom within our own homes. What can we do about it? I think we have to get out there and we have to basically say this is not acceptable. And also, I think it also has to come down to those politicians you are elected need to stand up and say this is not acceptable. Whatever party you're from, this is a free country. We need to stop people privacy being invaded in this fashion.
Well, there is one thing you can do. It's just occurred to me, and it's another person I interviewed earlier this week for the Dialect programme at dialectradio.co.uk, and that's Silky Carlo, who runs something called Crypto Parties. She's a Cambridge graduate, Martin and I have met a while ago, and what she does is she'll turn up for groups of journalists and bloggers. Particularly, she's more interested in talking to people who are doing some sort of internet investigations, that sort of thing, and she will explain to them what you can and can't do to keep that data that's on your computer secret and to keep nosy people out. So those are Crypto Parties. Her name's Silky Carlo. I'd suggest you have a look for her online, and maybe she'll even come and do a crypto party for you in her spare time, which is what she does. Martin, what can we do about an overmighty secret service spying on things we're doing without actually having the checks and balances of warrants from courts saying whether or not it's justified or not?
Well, I would argue that the civilian police force, answerable to democratically elected politicians, have got to get their finger out and start dealing with the intelligence services. Not just because they spy on us, and incidentally, of course, it's in the US Constitution that private communications should remain private unless there is a warrant from a magistrate.
But that's America, that's not Britain.
But I mean, the point is that the principle is absolutely clear. Unless you have a warrant from a magistrate in relation to a crime that people think has been committed, there should be no right for the state to interfere with private communications at all, period. And I think that I would ultimately see we've got to rebuild the civilian police force and give them the tools to tackle political extremism at the top. And that means basically dismantling the security services, who I believe are the fundamental purveyors of Islamist terrorism.
Not quite sure how to come back to that. But I think what we do is we do need our elected politicians to start acting like elected politicians and stand up to these sort of laws that have been introduced, and also I think down at local authority levels, my understanding that some of these laws will be at the discretion of local authorities to use, and I think some local authorities have to stand up and say we won't be using these laws and we won't allow them to be used in any area under which we have any control.
Well, time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guest, that was Bristol's Green Party mayor candidate Tony Dyer. Annual commemoration day at Colston Girls School after the news. Charter day for the merchant venturers. Hundreds of school children bust in to Bristol Cathedral to listen to Bishop Mike's secret sermon while the parents are locked outside.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, the Pentagon says it's...